Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon, Hard Knock Radio, and I'm awestruck. You know, I'm awestruck because of our guests, and I'm awestruck because of the product that they just put out that is just compelling. On the phone lines with us, you know her, well-known activist, Panther, Kathleen Cleaver. How are you?
Fine. I'm happy to be talking to you.
And in the studio with us from Freedom Archives, Claude Marks. How you doing?
Good, Davey. Thanks for having us on.
First, COINTELPRO 101. Congratulations on this film. I think it's probably one of the most compelling documentary that I've seen in a while, you know, especially because it's bringing a whole lot of information and perspectives that I think many of us overlook. And I'll start with either one of you, either Kathleen, maybe you could start, or you, Claude. The first thing that struck me was just seeing the extent that COINTELPRO was used on other organizations outside of the Black Panther Party. Most of us see the two as one and one, COINTELPRO, Black Panther Party. But to know what they were doing to the Puerto Rican independent movement, the Chicano movement, the Native American movements, was just eye-opening and riveting. Can you comment on that?
Well, the COINTELPRO is just an acronym. It means counterintelligence. Counterintelligence is a war measure that's taken out of what in the 20th century called like counterinsurgency. So if you like to kind of put down a revolution or put down a revolt, you want to spy on the enemy and get information and confuse them. So these are the techniques. So when we say COINTELPRO, it's actually an acronym for a whole set of programs the FBI developed in starting in the 50s during the Cold War against the communists. They were subsequently implemented to affect all kinds of other individual movements, but the Panther Party was one of the last.
Right, and that's what I think a lot of us, you know, including myself, didn't realize. And because a lot of times when we talk, you know, there seems to be a push to separate the different movements, at least amongst a lot of people that I come across. You know, they just want to be in their own silos. And maybe you could talk about the importance of us being able to connect the dots in other arenas.
Well, I think there's a couple things that I would say. First of all, that the level of government war was broad. It was broader than the Panthers, as you mentioned, because it included people like Martin Luther King Jr. It included people like Malcolm X. It included SNCC. It included a lot of movements within the Black liberation struggle. Mm-hmm. But then as you imply, and as we try to explain in the film, the way that the indigenous struggle is targeted, starting with a level of intelligence that they developed in 1969 around the occupation of Alcatraz, the militarization of attack of Wounded Knee that happens in the early 70s. In the case of the Puerto Rican independence movement, which goes back to the colonial invasion of the U.S. in 1898, but the actual counterintelligence work against it impacts on thousands and thousands of people, and millions of files are collected by the U.S. to try to derail it, to try to prevent the reassertion of independence by the Puerto Rican struggle. The level of disruption of the Chicano Mexicano movement is also attributed to the counterintelligence program. And we try to give a sense in the film that this is part of a larger whole, and actually part of a larger whole that hasn't gone away simply because the acronym has changed.
You know, I know, Kathleen, you talked about this being a set of programs that they used against people in wartime situations, so to speak. The question is it, you know, when we look at COINTELPRO, was it really looking at just people of color or at somebody who just held a particular ideology? What would trigger the types of activities?
Well, let's understand one thing. There had never been, since its creation, the FBI had only had one head, J. Edgar Hoover. And J. Edgar Hoover had a particularly specific view towards Black people. Essentially, they should be subservient. He also was a strong perpetuator of white supremacy. His family originates in Mississippi. And so white supremacy is one of the things that they're upholding, and also political separation. This whole idea that the Black Panthers had of a rainbow coalition and groups coming together and challenging together collectively their oppression is the anathema to the FBI, wants to keep them fighting each other and keep, you know, classes, maintain a very hierarchical, racist political order that has a certain level of orthodoxy. That's his goal.
The other thing that I think is mind-boggling for a lot of folks is the extent in which these operations would take place. I mean, in the Puerto Rican segment, we hear about, you know, people marrying and then disrupting after they were married into, you know, to the family of the activists. We hear about the murders, 64 murders in the Native American movement, of course, Panthers being murdered and what have you. And, you know, for a lot of people, you know, that are in the movement, that's, you know, we get that. But for a lot of other folks, it's like, no, our government wouldn't do that against folks. Maybe you can explain to the degree that this was going on. And the fact that nobody's been brought to task for that is also mind-boggling, considering how many thousands of people were impacted.
It's mind-boggling because too many people believe the mythology of what they call democracy. That's not. It's tyranny. And it's a racial tyranny, and it's a political tyranny, and it's extraordinarily oppressive. So it's more like the tactics of the Soviet Union than of what they propose is America. So the people who are the recipients of these tactics, however, have not necessarily been a beneficiary of what they call democracy. They're natives, they're outsiders, they're blacks, they're poor, they're communists, they're people for whom citizenship has been even a questionable attainment in many cases. They use techniques that the ordinary, average, white, law-abiding person that they claim they're protecting doesn't know about. But these are war techniques. They use torture. They use psychological torment. They use criminal behavior. They use assassination. This is what you do to your enemies. And that's what they did to us.
That's the voice of Kathleen Cleaver, also in the studio with us, Claude Marks. We're talking about their new documentary, which is called COINTELPRO 101. You know, one of the things that you all did was make the connection between the Patriot Act and Homeland Security and what have you. Can you elaborate on that? You know, how should we really view this? And also just keeping in mind what just recently happened with the raids upon all these anti-war activists around the country, you know, from Minneapolis on down.
Well, one thing is to put the historical COINTELPRO into perspective. Looking at it today, one presumes that a lot of the surveillance and stuff is done electronically. It's all done with computers. You know, the level of attack that we're talking about here happens in an era that predates a lot of the technology. So they really created armies of people that were sent out in order to conduct this counterinsurgency. Today, what was in the 70s exposed and brought forth to Congress with a certain self-professed awe and oh my God, can this really be happening? You know, the malfeasance, the criminality of COINTELPRO back then, today is legitimized by the changes in things like the Patriot Act. The ability of the United States to function with impunity in the world has amped up so much, and the level of technology that's available to them is so great that they can function today in a sense with full acceptance of what, you know, some 30, 40 years ago was seemingly, you know, a shock to people who were adherents of a democratic process.
Right.
And so when you see the kinds of raids that are undertaken, you know, within the last few weeks, you know, once again, people are saying, how can this happen? Well, it's really not that much of an anomaly. It's exposed. There's a level of response, but I think we're going to see an ongoing level of kind of sanctimonious, we can get away with this kind of stuff, even under Obama, and that's just kind of the landscape that we're functioning in today.
What do we do in 2010 with that sort of reality?
Keep struggling,
absolutely.
Keep fighting, and recognize that the warfare state that was put in place to maintain American supremacy and, you know, destroy communism in Vietnam has not gone away, and that it's a petroleum-based warfare state that we're up against, and Obama is president of that. Anyway, brothers, I have to go.
Well, Kathleen, we appreciate you coming on and sharing with us, and we're going to be on the lookout for the premiere of this film and hopefully when it's out there for everybody to consume. So thank you.
And congratulations, Claude. It's a great achievement.
Well, you're part of it, and thanks, Kathleen.
Okay, bye-bye.
There you go, Kathleen Cleaver leaving us right now. Let me ask you, Claude, is there anything that comes into mind that is equal, that is as egregious today in modern times as some of the stuff that was taking place, you know, when COINTELPRO was at its height as depicted in the films during the heydays of civil rights and freedom struggle movements?
Well, I think it's more egregious because they don't even hide the fact that they do it. They claim the right to assassinate people, even U.S. citizens, anywhere in the world. They protect rendition, which is a way of essentially passing on the torture to some other party. A huge percentage of the military warfare that's conducted in the world is done through private contractors that are unaccountable either to the U.S. government, certainly not to any populace, where... You know, there are some laws that restrict or restrain what the military can get away with, if we can use the term, in Afghanistan or Iraq, but that doesn't apply to the private contractors that are there. Guantanamo is still open. And the victims, and I want to say something about the people who remain victimized by this process of trying to dismantle revolutionary movements and movements for liberation and self-determination within the U.S., and we're talking about people like Mumia Abu-Jamal, other political prisoners like
right.
Leonard Peltier, like Oscar Rivera, and these people who remain caged because of their commitment to a different kind of world and the movements that they were a part of, they remain in U.S. prisons, and that issue is essentially denied. You know, the U.S. is trumpeting this and that about political prisoners here and there in the world, and yet here in our own country,
they won't even recognize
them. They won't recognize it. And of course, the mass imprisonment that is just as large a part of this issue, you know, the largest percentage of imprisonment in the history of the world here in the United States, part of social control, part of a genocidal attack on black and brown communities for sure.
Right.
I mean, those issues are even more acute than they were 40 years ago because they just keep accelerating.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Claude Marx from the Freedom Archives about their new documentary, COINTELPRO 101. The psychological games that have been played, not just to the victims, but it also seems like the public at large, where when a victim comes forward and says, this is what our government has done, people, you know, they can't believe it, and they poo-poo it. You know, you say we have political prisoners, and yet people go, no, not in the United States. So this American exceptionalism, if you can use that term, is something that is deeply ingrained in a lot of folks. And I'm not sure if it's a direct response to the type of COINTEL tactics that we use, but it's a reality that we face. But with that being said, what I was looking at and what stood out to me was like with the Chicano movement, and you highlighted that there was these right-wing vigilante groups that were going after folks. And I'm thinking to myself, is that the Tea Party today? You know, is that the hate groups that are rising up today that actually have their sights on brown folks, while a lot of black folks will look and be like, nah, even now, go, you know, if you tell people like, well, you know, the war on immigrants has neo-Nazis and Klansmen going after, you know, Latinos, you have a lot of folks go, no, that can't really be, and they'd be black, you know, because that's how much investment we have in this country or how detached we are from other people's histories.
Well, as you say, I don't think there is that significant a difference between the militia running the border for the United States by basically, you know, attacking people from Mexico or Central America trying to cross a border that was imposed by conquest in the first place.
Right.
Or the way that the police and the Klan have functioned for generations in the South in attacking not just the civil rights movement, but any number of other attempts for black people to assert their rights over property or their legitimate rights under the so-called democratic process that we're governed by.
Right.
So, you know, the commonness of that experience, while it may seem to be somewhat different from, you know, one population to another, is both a rural thing and an urban thing. I mean, we see it in the form of the way the police function in our communities, the assassinations of people like Oscar Grant, but this is a process that's taking place all over the country. It's becoming difficult even to keep up with it in the sense of gathering information because it's so common.
You know, that's real talk right there. As we get ready to close out, a few years ago there was the term Rap COINTELPRO, and a lot of people were looking at the surveillance that police departments were doing on rappers, in particular out of New York. We know one of the original cops out of Utah who has tremendous archive of information, but at least when you talk to him, his thing was to make sure that everybody knew he was doing this. But the point is that this intelligence gathering in our communities, looking at rap and then using that as a pretext to look deeper into the gangs and what have you, how do we deal with that? Because that seems to have disappeared off the map in terms of conversation, but I can't believe that the policies and the activities have disappeared. And do you make a connection to what was going on there with what you all are talking about in the film?
I think one thing that we try to articulate in the film is that in some ways the attack is against some very literal things, organizations. But in other ways, the psychological effect is a chilling effect, as an attempt to make the cost of resistance so high that people are intimidated. And part of the attack that the government wages is against the potential for there to be a level of challenge and a level of resistance,
preemptive strike
to the powers that be, a preemptive strike. This is what we see when they start to round up activists before an event even takes place, ostensibly to protect us from terrorism. Mind you, they've redefined terrorism as any form of resistance, the criminalization of dissent. This is equally true in terms of cultural expression when it emerges and articulates a form of resistance from within a community, because it, of course, you know, in the form of rap or any kind of cultural expression, has a tremendous potential to move people,
right,
much more so than, you know, somebody sitting in a classroom and giving a lecture or even showing a film like ours.
Right.
And so because of its mass nature, it has to be isolated and disrupted and destroyed because it can reach so many people. And what is the worst thing that they fear? A level of social discontent that they can't control.
Well, real talk right there. My last two questions. There's a lot of talk in recent days, primarily from people who have right-leaning tendencies, as far as I'm concerned, that talk about the New World Order. And as a result, they don't want any sort of regulation. They don't want the government involved in anything of the Alex Jones type crowd. They talk about the Bilderberg group and this group and that group. And they, you know, they bring all this information up. And I'm thinking to myself that, well, gosh, anybody who's lived in a community that's been under COINTELPRO, what's the difference? Or is there a difference? Is there a level, or is this maybe the COINTELPRO stuff, is that a tool for these higher corporate elitist type interests?
Well, it's partly, you know, a corporate and economic set of things. But when Kathleen made the point that it's at the very core white supremacist, we can't forget that. The way that the right is targeted, the way that white people who are discontent with too much government control are targeted, is extremely different. I experienced it when I was in prison and was side-by-side with people from the militia.
Right.
Yes, they were there. They hated the government, but they were bigots. They were racists.
Right.
And, you know, we don't have a unity to strike with them for that reason, because their ideal world, their vision isn't a more humanitarian world. It's a world of white supremacy in which they are unrestrained. The government has to pay some lip service to that, because that too has to be controlled. But it's not met with the ferocity and the violence that is directed at, like, the Black Liberation Struggle or the Puerto Rican Independence Movement or the attempts for indigenous people to reclaim their land.
Right. It's a thing of, what you call it, replacing one power with another, whereas with us it's really trying to get rid of a system to accommodate those who have been oppressed by a particular system. Is that a way to best describe it?
I think you have to frame it in terms of genocide.
Yeah.
That this is, you know, it has its historical roots. Who is in the prisons?
Yeah.
I mean, that's not, you can't hide the essence of it by looking at who are these 2.4 million people who are caged.
Right.
That's not white.
Yeah. And many of us can't even get our heads around that. The next step for you all right now with this movie, where are you going with it? The documentary, is it going to be a book? Other spin-off documentaries, what's next?
Well, to start with, we want to get it out to campuses and into communities. We want to get it to young people. We want to go viral with it at some point so that it's available on a mass level. It's not something that people have to purchase in order to get the information.
Right.
You know, our last film, Legacy of Torture, talked about the history behind the San Francisco 8 case and really impacted on a lot of people. And we have done some work in figuring out how to bust out information in a way that reaches a lot more people than just the most narrow and already conscious or the people on the campuses.
Right.
So anything that we can do, any help that we can get to make that happen, that's the goal. The goal is to give a historical context that allows people to frame their own experience today and to be smarter about how they look at their relationship to this government.
There you go. We've been talking with Claude Marks. You could check him out, or actually his organization, freedomarchives.org. You can get information on the film COINTELPRO 101. They have a nice little trailer and other things like that. And more importantly, find out about the organization, because they do a lot of work, have a lot of other things, other projects. Of course, the film around the SF-8 was landmark and something that educated a lot of us. So we want to thank you and Kathleen Cleaver for being on the show this afternoon. We're out for now. Peace.